Okay, so the title has changed. That was a tentative title, and now that I've thought more about it, I have sort of a more crisp title. So I'm going to talk about asset pricing and information. I'm not going to answer a lot of questions today, mainly because basically I have no answers. This is more going to be a tutorial where we ask a lot of interesting questions that might be answered with the type of methods that we've seen here during these 2 weeks of tutorials. I'm coming in sort of with a finance view of these type of methods that we have been discussing here, and let's discuss now for an hour or so what you could use these methods for. So what I'm going to do is, so it would be a very boring talk. Okay, now let's see. Yes, very good. Okay. So we're back on track. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to give a background and introduction to asset pricing, because I know that many of you don't really have a big background here. So this is more sort of to be clear on what type of questions we want to ask with these type of that we want to ask, that we can analyze with these type of methods. Then I'm going to talk a bit about empirical analysis, specifically about style classification of problems in asset pricing, where we actually have done some really, really early work. So I will have a couple of nice graphs with eigenfunctions to show you. And then finally, I'm going to go to what I think is the most interesting part here, is the theoretical part of asset pricing and information. And this is more visionary, if you will. I mean, there's not much work done at all, especially not by me, in this field. But I think that basically, if we want to understand how information gets into asset prices, then there are a lot of interesting questions we can ask, where we can sort of more apply the theory of information diffusion. So I'm going to spend about half the talk on this first introduction here. So let's take a bird's-eye view of financial markets. So when we talk about financial markets, we mainly think about stock markets. In the US, there are about, in the neighborhood of 15,000 publicly traded stocks. Many of these are not traded very often. So if you look at the major stock exchanges, like the New York Stock Exchange, the American Stock Exchange, and the NASDAQ, we're talking more like 7,000 stocks. The market size is something like $11 trillion, or it varies a lot depending on what happens in the market. So it's been up towards $18 trillion, but I think now it's later, $11 or $12 trillion or something like that. Here we got a lot of data, obviously, because these stocks are traded day by day. So we've got daily data for these stocks, at least back until 1963. The database that we typically use is the so-called CRISP database, which is the Center for Research in Security Pricing, I think it stands for. This database gives us the right return data. So basically, it gives the return day by day of a stock, but it takes into account stock splits and dividends and these type of things that you're not going to get if you, for example, naively go to Yahoo and download data from there. There are also a lot of funds out there. So basically, a fund is a fund invests in a portfolio of stocks. So there are mutual funds, pension funds, hedge funds, and there are a lot of these out there. So there are like 8,000 mutual funds, 9,000 hedge funds, and this number, I think, probably there are like 200 new hedge funds started every day or something like that. So this is not an actual number today, but it is quite interesting to see here that. The number of funds together are actually more than the number of stocks. So you might wonder, what are all these funds doing? Why do we need so many funds when they basically try trading these underlying stocks? And we will discuss a bit about this. There are other asset classes that I'm not going to talk about, like derivatives and bonds. Basically, a bond you may think of as going to the bank and putting the money on the bank and earning some interest, and you know what interest you're going to earn, at least if it's a government bond. Then there are corporate bonds, and there you basically go and you go to a company and you buy a bond, and the company promises to, say, pay you $110 1 year from now if you give the company $100 today. Obviously, this is more risky than investing in a U.S. government bond or a treasury bond, because the company may default, go into bankruptcy, and then it's not going to pay you this so-called coupon payment or principal payment 1 year from now. And you take that into account. So you will demand a higher interest rate if you buy a corporate bond than if you buy a government bond. But these two big asset classes are sort of the ones we trade off against each other when we invest our money. Do we put the money on the bank, or do we invest the money in stocks?
So, yes. I'm not clear, but there are funds in more than 50% of the market. So, do you mean the amount of dollar is...
Yes,
like
the dollar amount is more than 50% of the $11 trillion here. And this, the key point here is that a lot of the investments, I mean, this is well above 50%, is actually going to be made by these institutional investors, which are very different from, you know, the average Joe guy who sits there and says, hey, let's buy some 100 shares of IBM stock here. And people really think that it's these institutional investors that actually set the stock price, and they are fairly sophisticated. So, you know, that's sort of a basic fact we will have in mind when we start talking about what actually decides asset prices. Okay, so, yes.
When you say that, does that mean, like, for some of the larger hedge funds, they know that the actions that they're taking are affecting the market, so it's...
Definitely, definitely. There will be a lot of games going on here when we reach the information part of the talk, yeah. Okay, so why would you invest in the stock market? Well, let's see what would happen if you had invested $1 in the so-called S&P 500 index, which is a proxy for putting your money in a basket of stocks that represents the whole market. So if you had $1 and you invested it on January 1st, 1926, then in 2000, you would have $2,587. So that's a pretty big increase. On the other hand, if you had invested in a bond, a short-term bond, a T-bill, so that's sort of putting the money on the bank, you would have less than $17. So the difference here is obviously huge, and if you do the calculations, something like 7% per year difference. So that's the risk premium of investing in the stock market per year versus investing in bonds. So now we might say, well, why would anyone invest in bonds if there's such a big difference, right? You earn 7% more per year on average by investing in stocks. We should invest all the money, all the time in stocks, right? Well, there's something that is different between this curve and this curve, as we see. I mean, clearly this is a much smoother curve than this is, right? So the stock market is more risky than investing in bonds. If we buy a bond, we know exactly what we're going to get. If the whole US government doesn't default, which we think is a very, very low-risk event. So this is basically risk-free, whereas this is risky, and we see that there are actually periods of time when the stock market goes down. Another interesting curve here, so we've got a couple of other investments. This blue one, which is the best investment you can make, is investing not in the whole stock market. You actually single out small stocks and only invest in those, and then it turns out that you would make even more money, so you get sort of an extra percent per year or something like that if you only invest in so-called small capitalization stocks.
So,
yes.
How much is $2,587 just before inflation?
The average inflation is perhaps 2% per year, so take away the 2%, 7% minus 2% here, and you're down to sort of 5%, and this is basically, I think, something like 2%. So,
I mean, in terms of dollars, you know,
yeah, in terms of dollars, well, you should divide this by 16 or 17 or something like that, I guess. So, I don't know the number. Okay, so here is a slide that captures the high variability of the stock market. So, this is the annual return per year of stocks, and here with the blue line here is the annual return of bonds. And basically, you know, you never lose money in nominal terms by investing in a bond. So it's always above zero, it's very smooth. Whereas the stocks, I mean, if you invest in a bad year, you can lose a lot of money, right? So here, during the Great Depression, you could lose 40% of your money in 1 year. And obviously, you know, so you got your life savings, your $100,000, you invest it, and then 1 year later you only have $60,000 left. So that's clearly a big risk to take into account, even though you know that on average you're doing quite well. And here we got the OPEC crisis in the 70s, another really, really bad years, bad year for investments. So one way to capture this variability is the standard deviation of the annual returns, which is something like 17%, 15 to 18% for the stock market. And one number that is important here is the so-called Sharpe ratio, to capture the relation between the annual risk premium and the annual volatility. So it's basically the return on the stock market minus the return on the risk-free rate, which I call RF, divided by the volatility of the stock market. So that would be our 7% divided by the 17%, which is something like 35%. Or somewhere between 30 and 40%. And that's the so-called Sharpe ratio of the stock market, which is a summary statistic for how uncertain it is to invest in the stock market. So why am I pushing this point? Well, it turns out that this is a very high uncertainty, and it makes it difficult for us to do statistical tests on the stock market. So basically, if we make just the simplest assumption here, well, let's assume that the stock market follows a geometric Brownian motion with constant coefficients. And then we plug in this type of Sharpe ratio. So I'm actually going to plug in slightly smaller Sharpe ratio to make the numeric simpler here, but it's in the same neighborhood. So assume that the annual Sharpe ratio of the market is 0.2. And now we look at the stock prices, or we look at the log stock prices, because we've got a geometric Brownian motion, and we want to go to an arithmetic Brownian motion. And then we say, well, if the Sharpe ratio is 0.2, and now we follow the stock prices for 100 years, how sure will we be that the stock will, in 100 years, return more than the bond? And it turns out that 100 years is what is needed for us to reach a 95% probability of the stock to be higher than the bond. So there's actually a reasonable chance that in a 100-year period, the whole stock market would underperform the bond if these are the numbers that we plug in. And an equivalent formulation is obviously that statistically getting a good significance level here is going to be quite difficult, right? If we just plug in some statistical method and say, hey, you know, let's see how sure we can be that this drives returns and that this stock returns more than another stock, it's going to be very difficult to get statistical significance. And so the key point that I'm making here is that it's not going to be enough to do some black box empirical test if you want to say something about the stock market, because the uncertainty is just too high. You know, we only got one set of data. We have the stock market from 1900 to 2000. We've got 100 years of data, and we can't repeat it or anything. And this high Sharpe ratio makes it difficult to get an empirical test. So we're going to have to combine some theory together with empirical tests to get a fair comfort level on, you know, that we're actually saying something about the stock market. So black box empirical test is not going to be enough. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, yes.
What's the validity of this Brownian motion additive model?
Pardon?
But the validity of this Brownian additive Brownian motion is not as dubious in some sense.
Yes, obviously it is. I mean, you could argue that this introduces even higher uncertainty, right? Because now you've got some structural uncertainty. I mean, it's not clear at all that the stock market in 1900 is anywhere close to the stock market in 2000, right? I mean, the number of stocks out there has sort of increased tenfold or something like that, and the investor base is much bigger, which means that in reality we've got a much smaller data set than 100 years, and if things change over time, it's going to be even more difficult. So I think that's the key implication of, you know, the market actually truly not being following this constant coefficient geometric Brownian motion process. Yes.
The point is one data set. I mean, can't you construct more data sets? Because isn't the behavior over 100 years similar to the behavior over a period of 5 days in the trading?
Well, but the thing is, so, you know, if you want to estimate the drift term of a Brownian motion, the only thing that is interesting is the time length you have. It doesn't matter if you got, you know, perfect data, you know, over a second at a time, right? I mean, it's only the end point minus the first point. That's the sufficient statistics for this estimate. So you're not going to be able to, you know, perhaps you're thinking of some bootstrap. Okay, so this one implication here is that you know, there's some wariness for this type of black box approach, and this is sort of captured in these two quotes here. So one is from Business Week about if you just do a black box approach, you might not find the right answer. And an example here is David Lineweber, who tried a lot of macroeconomic predictors to see what can he use to predict the stock market the best way, and it turned out that the butter production in Bangladesh was the best predictor of the S&P 500. So, you know, if you just took a pure empirical black box approach here, you could say, yeah, okay, so let's now see what the butter production in Bangladesh has to say about the stock market in the future. Yes?
What's the butter production in Bangladesh right now?
Okay, you need to look it up. I don't follow, you know, his advice. I don't think his advice was to invest in the butter index in Bangladesh. Now, but the point here is that you're going to find a lot of wrong answers, so we need to combine the theory with the empirical study. Okay, so what do we do? Well, here we go back to classical decision theory. So the so-called expected utility approach to asset pricing was introduced by von Neumann and Morgenstern towards the end of the 40s in their book Theory of Corporate Games, or Theory of Games. So what they do is they say, well, if you want to invest in the stock market — they don't say that, but I say that, it's sort of the stock market equivalent here — if you want to invest in the stock market, what is important for you is, well, it's, first of all, it's not the money itself, right? Money has no value other than providing a means for you to consume. So your utility, which we call it capital U here, is a function of your expectation of what you're going to consume over time. So you think of this as some instantaneous consumption over time. Then we integrate this over your lifetime. And then you say, well, the total utility you got was the expected consumption. And so consumption here is C as a function of time, and it's got this little tilde above because it's stochastic. So if we invest in the stock market, then we don't know actually how much we're going to be able to consume in the future. So it's going to be stochastic, and we want to take an expectation. But it's actually not the pure expectation. It's the expectation of some function times this consumption. And this function, under some fairly general assumptions, will be a concave function. So if it would just be a straight line, then we're back to basically saying, well, the expectation of what you get in the stock market, that is the only thing you care about. But now we have this concave curvature of your utility function. And this exactly captures this, that you're afraid of volatility, or is it an even more general statement than that? So we said that, well, you know, we don't invest all our money in the stock market, even though on average it might do better than the bond market, because it's much more volatile. And the decision theoretic approach motivates this, and it actually introduces one way of measuring this by seeing how concave is this utility function. So basically, if you're going to choose between a sure investment now and something that, say, with 50% chance generates this and 50% chance generates this, then it's a pure Jensen inequality thing that shows that you will actually like better a 100% chance of getting this point than a 50% chance of getting this point and a 50% chance of getting this point. So we're going to have to do something with the expectation. We're basically going to subtract some type of measure of the variability of the returns you get to see how you would actually invest your money. And what will fall out here is that you'll put some money in the bond market and some money in the stock market, which is clearly what we see people do. So, well, this sounds very theoretical. Now, has this really had any impact on our investments? Well, it's actually had tremendous impact on the way we think about investments. So one thing that has really changed in the last 40 years is how much we invest in so-called passive investments. So that would be investing in the S&P 500, just buying the stock market index. And I'm sure many of you hold index funds nowadays. So, for example, the Vanguard S&P 500 index fund, or there are ETFs, exchange-traded funds, that sort of mimic the stock market. So just to get a little sample here, how many of you have bought any index fund investments? Quite a few. It should be more of you. So those who haven't, you might consider it.
Yeah, why?
Yeah.
How many of you are using Grassley?
Okay. That's a fair point. So in 1970, these index funds, they didn't even exist. So the volume of investments in index funds was zero. And in 2004, they captured 25% of the stock market. So they've exploded, and it's basically been driven by this type of analysis that says that we shouldn't really, you know, stock market investments, it's not about finding the stock that returns much, much more than another stock. It's doing this risk-return trade-off, and basically picking one or two stocks is going to give much, much more volatile returns than you would get if you pick a whole basket of portfolios. So basically there's some type of law of large numbers that hits in there, and the prediction would be that you should sort of invest in the stock market if you have not, if you don't have superior information compared with very, very smart, sophisticated investors. So that was the von Neumann-Morgenstern theory of gains, where they introduced this expected utility formulation. Now this was taken one step further, sort of leading up to what I was talking about here, by Markowitz and Roy in the 50s. So what they did is they had made some very stylized assumption about stocks, what their returns are. So let's assume that we're in a normal return world, and we only live for one period, so it's a very simplified model, but it gives some stylized facts that are interesting. So there are n stocks in the market, and this mu here is the expected return, so it's an element in Rn, a vector, and this is a Rn times n variance-covariance matrix that is non-singular. So let's assume now, for simplicity, that this is the distribution of stock returns. And then we got one of these expected utility optimizer following the axioms of von Neumann and Morgenstern, who cares about exactly the expected returns, but worries about the variance of the returns, or the variability of the returns. So this person makes some type of trade-off here, by investing in a stock market portfolio. So what is a stock market portfolio? Or is some Q vector, and then we multiply this with the return. So that is going to be your stochastic portfolio returns, right? So this Q vector is something that sums to one. If we're not allowed to short sell stocks, well then it must have non-negative elements. So it's something in on the Unix unit simplex. But nowadays you're allowed to short sell stocks. So you could basically think of it as any type of vector where the elements sum to one. And if you don't know what short selling is, you can ask me afterwards, but I don't want to spend time on that now. So basically think of this as any vector where the elements sum to one. So which type of investment should you do then? Well, this is obviously a simple quadratic optimization problem, and you just solve it. And then what falls out is quite interesting. So it actually what falls out is a one-factor model for what should asset returns look like. So the return of the expected return of an individual stock, so this is element I of this mu vector here, is equal to the risk-free rate plus some stock-dependent component, which we call beta I, times this risk premium. So the risk-free rate, well, something like 3% per year, and this is the 7% that we captured in this earlier figure here. This beta, what does that measure? Well, it's the covariance between the returns of the individual stock and the returns of the stock market, scaled with a variance of the stock market returns. So what does this tell us? Well, it says that stocks that covary a lot with the stock market should have higher expected returns. They must return more than stocks that have totally no correlation at all with the stock market. And it makes a lot of sense from a law of large numbers perspective. If there are a lot of stocks out there, and we got stocks that don't really co-vary with the stock market, well, we can form a big portfolio of these stocks, and we're basically diversifying away all the risk, so we don't really care about the individual stock risk, right? Because they're not going to contribute to our portfolio risk, and that's the only risk that we care about. If, on the other hand, we have a stock that co-varies a lot with the stock market, well, then it's actually going to contribute to the total risk of the portfolio, so we're going to have we're going to require a higher return here. So why is this interesting? Well, this creates a model that actually tells us something. Well, this is, you know, a hypothesis is that this is what the expected returns for different stocks look like. And now we've got something that we can test against and see, well, you know, does the world adhere to this model, or are we far away from this model? What else does it tell us? Well, it also gives another interesting implication here, and that says that it's not as easy just to say, well, which stock returned more than another stock, and was that a good investment, right? So you could say that, well, I should have invested all my money in these small stocks because they had higher returns on average than the large stocks. Well, that's not really the key issue here. The key issue is, you know, all stocks in this model are fairly priced. It's just that some need to return more for us to buy these stocks because they have more risk. And if we want to have a model for which stocks are better priced than others, we also need to have a model for, well, what should the expected return of these stocks be? And it's not going to be constant across stocks. So just applying a black box saying that, well, I found the stocks that returned a lot, doesn't really tell me if these stocks were good and had abnormal returns, or if this was some type of risk that actually had a fair price, and I took on a risk by buying these stocks that was sort of ex post justified, but perhaps not ex ante justified. Okay, so if we apply this model to stock returns, it fails miserably, I would say. So this was developed by Sharpe and Lindner in the 60s, the capital asset pricing model I showed you earlier. And well, it tells something about the truth of stock market returns, but there are many, many so-called anomalies that don't fit nice into this structure. So for example, this the size factor, well, that was captured by the earlier slide I showed you there, that small stocks seem to have higher returns than large stocks, which wouldn't be motivated from the CAPM, because CAPM says that it's only this beta factor that matters for the returns. And there are other factors like the so-called value factor and the momentum factor that you can sort of buy a portfolio of stocks that seem to have higher returns than the rest of the market. There are also some interesting time series anomalies here, especially this excess volatility. So if you want to define a model for what should the stock price be of a company? I mean, what do you actually get when you buy the stock of a company? Any suggestions here? Why would you buy the stock of a company? I mean, you get a piece of paper, right? So why is it worth anything?
You think you can sell it to someone.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, you think you can sell it to someone, and that person thinks he or she can sell it to someone else, and you get some, you know, circular argument here. I mean, there's got to be something more than that.
It's a
decision
in the company policy.
Okay, so these are two. So Peter's point is you get dividends, and that's sort of the classical approach to say that, well, you buy the stock, and in principle there should be someone there who would be willing to buy the stock and hold it for a very, very long time, and then collecting the dividends, and the dividends that that person collects are sort of the same as the value or even higher than the value he paid for it when he bought the stock. So that would give a model where basically the price of the stock today should be equal to the sum of all the dividends you collect over time. Obviously this is stochastic, so you need to take some expectations, and then you need to discount, right? Because if you get the money far into the future, then it's worth less because you could have put the money on the bank and earned some interest. So this is a very simple model of what the price would be. Your point here would be that you there's another value, and that is that you actually buy an ownership stake in this firm. And that's sort of another type of theory. It's not the standard traditional theory of asset pricing, but it is a valid point. But this is sort of the simplistic theory, is you buy the paper, and now you've traded the price you paid for it now to, you offset, the dividends are going to offset the price you paid today, and overall you're going to be happy with this investment. Well, if this is the case, then if we take the standard deviation here, then basically the standard deviation of the price, right, should sort of be related to the standard deviation of the dividends over time. And if you do this type of calculation, it turns out that this doesn't hold at all. There's like a factor of 10 between these two, where the standard deviation of the price is much, much higher than the standard deviation of the dividends over time. And that's the so-called excess volatility puzzle. That, it's a stylized fact, but it doesn't seem to be captured by these standard models that I've shown you so far. Other things in the time series of asset returns, we see heavy tails. So this the geometric Brownian motion approach to asset pricing is clearly doesn't capture what is going on out in the tail. And one example is the stock market crash in 1987. Those of you who are old enough to remember that, so on October 19th, 1987, the stock market plunged with 20% in one day. As the daily average volatility of the stock market is 1%, this would be a 20 standard deviation event if we assume the standard Brownian motion stochastic process. So this is clearly not a good model for the tails of the returns. On a related issue is that there seem to be some type of systemic risks. So what does this mean? Well, it means that the average correlation over day to day of stocks, their returns, is one thing, but then every now and again, especially when these rare events hit in, these heavy-tailed events, the correlation seem to be much, much higher. So the, you know, the theory of just a covariance matrix doesn't really capture at all what is going on in the time series of stock prices, and you need some more advanced model, like nowadays sort of copula models are very popular here and being introduced. Non-linear time scale, I'm not going to talk about this. There's autocorrelation in the time series. It's very, very small, but there seems to be some autocorrelation, and it varies, it's non-monotonic over time, but it basically seems that the prices did well yesterday, that has a tiny, tiny predictive component that they're going to do well tomorrow too. And that is sort of, you know, if you think of the game theory of asset pricing, that this seems to be very strange, because basically, if everyone can infer this, that, okay, stock prices went up with 1% today, so they'll on average go up another 0.5% tomorrow, well, then everyone knows this, and they're going to buy, and they're going to bid up the price with the extra 0.5% today, right? So there's sort of some very basic theory should tell us that there should be some type of martingale properties of asset prices that do not seem to be captured in the real world. So these are the type of puzzles that we would like a better explanation to, and that are not captured by this classical model, the capital asset pricing model. And the questions are then, you know, what type of effects do we see? And that's an empirical question, but also a theoretical question. Why do we see these effects? Okay, so one step towards a full model here is the social called consumption cap, and I'm just going to touch upon this briefly in the interest of time. But basically, what the consumption cap says, and this was introduced towards the end of the 70s, so we're still back in sort of classical asset pricing theory, it says that, well, the assumptions of the cap, the one-factor model, are a bit too simple. So we need to introduce some world here that actually drives what is going on here. So I did a search on the internet for state of the world, and this wonderful picture came up, so I thought, okay, this is what I should include. So there's a state of the world that influences the asset prices, but it also has some influence on our utility, above and beyond what we get from asset prices. So we may think that, well, back to the consumption explanation of the world, obviously we get a lot of our wealth from stocks, or at least the wealthy people do, but there's also other sources of income, right? Labor. And labor is, for most people, quite a risky source of income. Not if you're a tenured professor, obviously, and you can do whatever you want and you'll get your wage. But for people working in the real world, you know, if a recession hits, you might get fired, right? And unfortunately, the recession seems to hit exactly at the same point in time as the stock market is down. And this is like a really, really bad situation for our concave utility function here, right? Because now we're sort of have two factors driving us down from a point up here to a point there. So in principle, we will be prepared to pay a lot of money to get insurance for such an event. So another way of saying that is to say that, well, we don't want to invest in stocks that do poorly when we tend to lose our jobs, because then we're sort of, we get the worst of both worlds. It's much better to invest in stocks that actually do well in the states of the world when we lose our jobs. So then we could have one effect driving us in that direction, but then we have an offsetting effect that drives us up. So we will have some type of hedging voting to choosing our portfolios, and different people will have different you know, interest in investing in those type of stocks, but there should be another factor. And the way of expressing this is to say that, well, the returns depend on some macroeconomic factor, think of it as a recession factor, but also our consumption depends above and beyond the returns on this factor too. And if you solve the optimization problem now, you will see that you will need two portfolios. There's one portfolio that is the standard CAPM portfolio, the covariance with the market. But there's another hedging portfolio that people will want to invest in just to offset these type of risks. And we now get a sort of a two-factor explanation of what the expected returns of stocks should be. And now we could sort of connect this and say, well, perhaps this is interest rate risk, or it's the employment in the economy, but we could see how we could introduce macroeconomic factors to get a multi-factor explanation of what stock returns should be. And for example, there are models that say that, well, perhaps the small firms are firms that pay off exactly in the good states of the world, but not in the bad states of the world. So people don't really want to invest in these because they don't give any insurance against unemployment risk, and therefore they will have higher returns than these other large firms that actually pay off exactly in the states of the world when we need the money. Okay, so that finishes the theoretical background here. And the two takeaways we should have from this part is, first, that the high uncertainty in the stock market means that we're going to need both theory and empirics if we want to say something valuable about the stock market. We're going to need some type of structural model. And the second thing is that it's difficult to define what it actually means to beat the market, because we have these different factors that are going to drive what the expected returns in the market should be, or for individual stocks. And we need we need to believe in such a model to actually be able to answer a question: did this stock, was this stock a superior investment, or is it going to be a superior investment or not? So those questions are tricky to answer, and there might be other questions that are better to approach if we want to have this type of empirical approach to asset pricing. So let me talk a bit about star classification problems here. Let me skip this in the interest of time. So I mentioned that there are a lot of funds out there, so the same number of funds as the number of stocks. And the question would be, well, why do people invest in these funds? Well, going back to theory, we would think that, if there are these factors governing our investments, these should be reflected in the funds out there, right? So if I'm very averse to unemployment risk, well, then there should be a mutual fund I could invest in that returns, get high returns exactly in those days of the world when I need them. So by doing some type of analysis of the funds, we could actually see people's revealed preferences, if you will. We could see what they actually worry about when they invest in the stock market and which factors they want to invest in. So this is quite a big literature, doing some type of a star classification of mutual funds. And one of the classical papers here is Brown and Goetzmann, 97. So they went out there, they looked at the time series of mutual fund returns. So there's the Morningstar database that gives returns from 1976 and forward on a monthly basis. For mutual funds, they are required to report to the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, so we have good data for those funds. And then they saw, well, doing some type of a clustering analysis, do these funds seem to cluster in the return space? So the time series was basically a few thousand funds, monthly returns over a 20-year period or something like that, or a 15-year period. And do a cluster analysis. They use standard k-means, and they identified 8 styles. Most of these styles were very much related to these factors, the size factor and the value factor I showed you earlier. But there's one here, the so-called global timing, that is an interesting one. So this gives us a hint why we may be interested in applying a more advanced algorithm here. So the global timing factor they found seemed to be a factor that is basically the fund manager chooses to stay in the stock market or get out of the stock market. So over time, he rebalances, or she rebalances, so that in some periods of time, the portfolio is almost only in bond investments, and in other periods, it's only almost in stock investments. So why would one want to do this? Well, remember now, the daily standard deviation of the stock market is 1%, and the average returns over a year is something like 10%, right? So if you, just as a thought example, could be out of the market all the days when the market is down and be in the market all the days when it's up, you would be able to earn astronomical profits here, right? So, hundreds of percent per year. Obviously, these funds don't try to do it at this high frequency level, but think of staying out of the market in October 1987 and avoid this 20% crash. Well, that would give you like 2 years ahead of all the other funds, right? If you could do that. And that's what these funds are trying to do. So why would that be important for us? Well, this is a very non-linear strategy. So even if the underlying stock return space is linear, if you have this type of dynamic, time-varying investment strategy, your time series of stock returns for the fund is going to be very non-linear. And using a standard linear classification algorithm might lead us very, very wrong here. I'm not going to mention hedge funds. Basically, the data for hedge funds is much more sparse, but the data is, on the other hand, more interesting because mutual funds are quite highly regulated, so you can't play these tricks to a too far extent, whereas hedge funds are, it's like the wild, wild west. They're totally unregulated, and they can do whatever they want. So if you have the data there, it would be interesting to do this type of analysis for hedge funds too. Let's stick with mutual funds for the time being. So another reason why we would expect these type of non-linear time series of fund data is the incentive schemes we give to the fund managers, especially for hedge funds. So a hedge fund manager basically gets compensated according to a so-called 220 rule. That's the standard contract, which means that you get 2% of the asset value per year. So if your fund signed size is $100 million, you get $2 million, plus 20% of the upside relative to some benchmark. So think of perhaps the S&P 500. So this is a very non-linear contract, and it would actually imply that if the hedge fund managers behave optimally, they will form very non-linear trading strategies based on this. So let's do an analogy here. I give you $1,000 and say, hey, go to Vegas, spend the night betting on the roulette table, and then I'll give you 20% of the upside, but I'll take everything. If you lose money, I'll get it back. So you come back with $500, I take the $500 and you don't get anything. If you come back with $2,000, well, then you made a profit, so I'll give you 20% of those 1,000 profit. So I'll give you 200. Now you're sitting there and, you know, it's approaching the end of the game. What are you gonna do? Assume now that you're 100 down, so you have $900, and your strategy so far has been that you bet $10 on black at the roulette table every time. So you get something that looks like a binomial distribution. Well, you only have one more time to play. You've got $900. If you put $10 and you win, well, then you have 910, and you're still not gonna get anything, right? Because you didn't reach this level of 1,000. So what do? Well, you put everything down, right? Or at least a large amount, so you get a good chance of going above 1,000. You have a big chance of losing everything, but you don't care. You get zero anyway, right?
You don't care.
Well, because I'm just going to give you, I mean, yeah, because, you know, I've delegated the investment, just like we do to our hedge fund managers, to you. So the return distribution, if you had followed a linear strategy, would look something like this, sort of binomial with many games. But what you're going to get, if you actually optimize, is something, well, there's no chance that you're going to return anything less than 1,000, because then you're just, in the last game, you're going to put everything there to have a reasonable chance of getting above 1,000, right? So you're going to get a very skewed distribution. It might look something like that. Well, it's typically going to have heavy tails if you solve this type of a problem, and there's basically no chance for low returns, except for minus 100%, obviously, which there's a big, big chance that you're going to get. So you get these very non-linear return distributions, and we would expect to see, at least for some funds, we would expect to see this in the fund universe. And typically, one of these non-linear classification algorithms we would expect to work quite well here. And this is actually a real example where we set up, still very simple, but in a two-period world. So we got funds that give returns in period one and in period two, and we've got two type of fund managers. One type that is compensated with a linear compensation strategy, and they will typically invest in a linear portfolio over time, so no dynamic trading strategies. And then we've got one hedge fund manager, type of hedge fund managers here that form portfolios that have these non-linear compensation structures, and they will typically form, then have non-linear returns in the return space. And I should mention that this is work by me, Peter, and Mauro, very early stage work in process, Mauro Maggioni. Yes.
I have a question. So does it mean that that if the manager is evaluated, say, each quarter, so by the end of the quarter, he's supposed to be much more aggressive, so we can expect an aggressive trading strategy?
Yeah, we don't know. So for hedge fund managers, we rarely see the data. Typically, it's more on an annual basis that they get compensated. And what they do in between, they're not required to report this. But we sort of would expect there to be some type of doubling strategies going on towards the end of
November, December.
Yes,
yeah.
Could
so
be. Yeah.
Keep up.
Or if you know something, stay in.
Well, there's a related strategy that even has a name. It's called window dressing. It happens exactly at the end of the quarter,
yep.
And it's like advertising where the command is always the same. Let's put some lipstick on this pig. Right.
Yep.
So you try to window dress.
Yep. So, you know, if we got these two types, so we've got a lot of points of active fund managers, and we've got passive fund managers, and then we try to classify this. Well, the right classification might be that we would actually not know what type of investments they're doing, if they're investing in telecom or not, which will sort of drive which part of the graph you lie in. We want to classify whether they're active or passive, because that gives us actually more information. And if we apply a naive k-means algorithm here, it's clear that it's not going to find anything, right? Because basically it's going to do something like this, and it's not going to be able to separate at all the non-linear from the linear training strategies. Now, it's not super simple to do this with a non-linear algorithm either, because these two actually cross each other. But, you know, we could at least be somewhat more optimistic to be able to separate this non-linear line from the linear line using some type of non-linear algorithm. So that's sort of the basis for why we even approach this type of data. And we've done some early work here. A grad student, or an undergrad student of Peter's, have run a lot of Laplacian eigenmap algorithms. And this is what we get. And I have nothing to say about this graph.
very beautiful,
a lot of different eigenvectors and classifications. And so it's very early stage still. But it seems to be, so very early results say that we do get good classes, sort of related to the standard classes that we saw that, for example, Brown and Gutzman found. We see, in a couple of these, we see some evidence of non-linear trading going on, which they would not capture with their k-means algorithm. Out of sample, these new classes that we've defined seem to perform better than the k-means algorithm, because that's sort of what we're interested in, right? We do an in-sample test, we look at the data for a number of years, and then we say, well, do these factors that we found, these styles, do they actually predict what will go on in the future? Not predict how to beat the market, but, you know, funds that are in one class, do they stay in the same class out of sample, or do they switch a lot? And are their returns explained to a high degree? Basically, do we have a high R-squared of the center of gravity of the cluster or something like that? Mm-hmm. And in both cases, so the out of sample behavior, both with respect to switching clusters and to factor explanation of returns, are better for the nonlinear algorithm than for the linear algorithm. That's still very early stage, but at least there are some positive indications here. Another data set that we looked at is an art style data set. So I mentioned this bird's eye view of the financial markets, and we saw other classes there, and real estate was mentioned. And art is another investment class that, you know, all of us do not buy art because we find paintings so beautiful. There are actually a lot of people who buy there as an investment because they want to make money. And it would be, you know, financial theorists think that you can apply the same type of asset pricing models to art data as you can to the stock market. Obviously, we have much less data and it's much noisier, but we did have access to a database with 20,000 paintings sold for about 60 artists over a 12-year period. And we wanted to say that, well, if we just run a clustering algorithm here and see the styles we find, you know, how are these painting returns related to the artist, which artists are in the same cluster, does this fit well with a standard classification of style that we would get if we actually went and asked an art expert? So we ran this test, and here unfortunately I only have the numbers, but few of them I actually know which are which. So this is basically the impressionist cluster that we found. So we got statistical significance that these price generated clusters actually do a pretty good job in separating out the real styles that an art historian would define. So this is Renoir here. We got the post-impressionist cluster. I don't know any post-impressionists. Well, we got, that's Picasso there. Is he a post-impressionist, Peter? Yeah, okay, very good. So you see how good the algorithm is. Okay, and we got the surrealist, the expressionist, and the pop art. And we've got Andy Warhol himself there as number 18. So we've got strong statistical significance that just by looking at the prices, we could do a fairly good job in reverse engineering the styles that art historians have.
What are the two axes?
So it's the two, it's the eigenvector 2 and 3 in the Laplacian eigenmap. And we applied, in this space, we applied a simple k-means algorithm to to define the clusters. Yes?
What vectors were the clustering? What are the vectors? What are you?
Okay, so you did. So you looked at the covariance matrix of the returns of asset price of art prices. So you now had a covariance matrix. Then you treated that as a similarity matrix and did the Laplacian diffusion mapping here. And then we looked at the eigenvectors of that map. So this was a few years ago, so that's the best answer I can get. But I'll, if you're interested, you know, I'll send you the paper because that's this is sort of completed work. But we were quite happy about that. We also checked the ages when the different artists were born and did some contingency tests with a null hypothesis that, you know, this had no explanatory power for the clusters we had. We had identified, and we got a strong rejection of the null here too. So we basically managed to reverse engineer these styles pretty well. And I should mention that when we did standard algorithms here, so we did a standard k-means clustering algorithm and some hierarchical tree algorithm, we found nothing. So this algorithm actually did better compared with those. Okay, so this leaves me with a few minutes to discuss something that I think is, you know, this is the empirical approach that you can take, and there, clearly there seems to be something that you can do with this type of data. So you can get contributions by these new algorithms. Another more high-level thing where I have no sort of answers or results to show you, but I want to just throw out, you know, some ideas here, is thinking about asset pricing and the topology of information, if you will. So if you think of it, the models I've shown you so far, there's no information there, right? When we explain why people invest, it's you want to hedge certain type of risk, but there's nothing that, yeah, I get a little, you know, insider tip that I should invest in this stock and then I go out and buy it. And the classical models didn't really take this asymmetric information into account. But towards the end of the 70s, there was sort of a huge interest in trying to do this. And the classical example is Grossman back in 76. So he basically said, what if everyone, there's only one firm here in his model, so let's simplify things. And now everyone gets a signal about what the value of this firm is. So the true value is some stochastic variable p tilde, and then you get a signal v, which is equal to p plus some noise. And everyone gets different signals. And now you would say, how should I invest here? And the standard thing, you know, you might think is say, well, you know, I've formed what is the conditional expectation of what the value is given the information I have. So let's, you know, find what is the expected value of p given that I know p plus epsilon, right? And you do some Bayesian updating and you find that, well, it's going to be something like sigma p squared divided by sigma p squared plus sigma s squared, where this is the variance of the signal, times the variable that you know. This is not the right approach. So, you know, it seems like, yeah, I'm using all the information I have. This is what my expected price is given the information I have, and now I go out and invest in the market. What are we missing here? What would you really do if in this little model? So we've got, you know, 10 investors, they all get their little price signals. They can form their expectations, and then we find a price at which the market clears. So everyone, you know, say that, well, I want to buy or I want to sell, and then we find a price that they're willing to buy at. That's not what you should do. Well, let me answer this question myself. You're not taking all the information into account, because there's this global information that is actually revealed by the prices themselves, right? Because once you see, I mean, you can get an indication of what everyone else's information is going to be by looking at what is the price of the stock. And it turns out that when you solve this little thing, so you're not only taking into account the signal, but you're actually taking into account the price that you see in the market. If you do this, it turns out that the only equilibrium that exists, so this is game theory, now you're optimizing not only with respect to your own information, but the information that you can filter out that everyone else has from what you see in the price. So there's this huge information going in this direction too. The only solution is one in which the price itself captures all the information. So all information is aggregated in the stock market, and there's no way to make excess money here, even if you get a very, very good signal. So this is one of these game theory constraints that is sort of gonna be there. If you know, if you ask me, what is the value of a Google stock today, right? I'm gonna say, well, you know, what is the price in the stock market? I mean, I'm basically getting all the information from the price I see. Some people have more information they might, you know, marginally want to take into account their own information. But it turns out that these type of models, it's all going to be swamped by the price information you get. And this is sort of, you know, obviously leads to some strange effects that, you know, if everyone believes in the stock price and they don't care about their own information, well, how does their own information get incorporated into the stock price in the first place and these type of things? But we leave those questions. The key take here is that it's the straightforward model of asymmetric information would not lead to the predictions that we might think, that the guy who gets the best signal makes the most money. It actually, all the information is aggregated in the stock market and no one really makes any money here. Everyone, after seeing the price, has the same information. So to get around this, in the beginning of the 80s, new models were introduced where you have so-called liquidity or noise traders. So basically there are some really, really stupid guys there who invest in the market without taking any information into account. They just go and say, I'm willing to buy this at any price. And if you introduce this type of noise, now you get a so-called noisy rational expectations equilibrium in which you can make some money on behalf of these guys mostly, and all information is not revealed in the market. But what I think, and this is sort of the state of the art that has been since in the beginning of the 80s when this was introduced. It's been generalized to multiple stocks, but it's still this very, very simplistic information structure here, right? Where everyone gets a unique signal, and there's no interrelation within the model that any information goes between people, whether it's some type of a network or a topology of information where you can actually say that, well, my information is closer to yours, so what is going to happen then? And we know that there are a lot of stylized facts of social networks, and you know, Janet mentioned several last week about heavy tails and things that should be important when understanding asset pricing. We see sort of the dual effects, I believe, in the stock market. We have these heavy tail distributions of returns, but there's no model out there that puts a more complex information structure, at least no finance model. I mean, there are clearly a lot of economics model where they begin, you know, sort of thinking about the theory of networks, but there's no nice finance model where we actually say, that, right, how does this influence stock prices, and can we explain these anomalies? There are some early works, let me skip this one, some early works where people are trying to do this now. So there's a paper by Ozoila, 2005, where he actually introduces some type of network structure. So you get your personal signal, but you also get to see at least partly the signals from your neighbors. So you've got some type of graph here, or it might be a directed graph. And now he tries to explain, well, what are the implications compared with these classical models to stock prices. And he shows that this excess volatility easily occurs. That was one of the anomalies I mentioned, right, in these type of models. But I think that if you could set up a dynamic model here, you know, there are a lot of these anomalies that seem to have direct mappings to what we think social networks look like. For example, the heavy tails and the autocorrelation. But that's sort of an open question, but that's one of the reasons why I'm here, is to sort of understand this more. Yes?
These models you've been describing, like, is this just referring to the equilibrium state, or do you actually model for the time behavior that somebody gets information about?
So equilibrium, there is always going to be equilibrium at each point in time. So equilibrium here is not the same as steady state. There's basically, you know, disequilibrium would be 1,000 guys want to buy them the stock, but there are only 500 that want to sell the stock at a specific point in time. That would be disequilibrium. And what we say is that, well, then the stock price will adjust to a level immediately where there are not, you know, 1,000 who want to sell and then 1,000 who want to buy, or somewhere in between. So that's what I mean when I say equilibrium. It's not sort of the steady state.
There must be some real time lag.
Yeah, there could be some delta T. I mean, typically these models are a continuous time, like Merton type models, and you know how well they explain the real world is an open question. But it, so. I think, so as I understood your question, when you talk about equilibrium, it was sort of what happens over time when people trade. But this is sort of, at every point in time, there's an equilibrium. I don't don't know if that makes it clear. We can discuss that, but I know that I'm clearly running out of time. This is the last talk. I know that I'm going to be killed if I go on for too long. So I'm basically finishing here. I think this is really interesting. I think the type of data sets we need is not enough to use the classical example is, let's study Google and see what the links are there, and then we get sort of some graph, and perhaps that is how information transmits through the market, and you can check sort of bulletin board and messages and discussion forums for stocks. These studies have been made. I think it's interesting if one could actually get down to the true nodes, which are not the internet pages or the stocks. It's actually the people. And there are some data sets that are potentially available where one could do this, I believe. But if anybody is interested in this, so we can discuss it afterwards. Okay, I'm done. 5 minutes over.